What I thought I'd do today is give you kind of tell you an extended anecdote about something that happened to me a number of years ago. And the anecdote involves some cryptographic issues. So I'll pause while telling the anecdote to kind of explain what's going on with the cryptographic side and use that to teach you about cryptography in general and in particular quantum cryptography. So the anecdote begins, I guess it was January 2001 or so, and I was at a conference in Washington, D.C. And the conference ended. I was ready to go home, so I went down to the subway late at night, and two kind of big men in dark glasses at night in the subway came up to me and said, "Dr. Gottesman," there was not too many other people around, "yes, please come with us." Okay, so I figured it was better to go with them. So they took me away into a car, dark windows, couldn't really see where I was going. We drove for a while, and eventually got out, went into a building. They brought me to a room, not much in the room. There was a chair, some kind of poster on the wall, and not much else. And then they left me there. I didn't have a whole lot to do, so I decided to examine this poster. And here's what it said. OK, so it's not too comprehensible a poster by itself. But like I said, I was kind of sitting there for a while. So I decided, well, maybe it was some kind of code, and I could work on trying to decipher it. I had some paper and a pencil with me. So I set to work. And after a while, here's what I noticed. I noticed that if you looked at every third letter in this code, that you'll find that some letters appear more frequently than others. Okay? And in particular, looking at every third letter meant that the frequencies of the letters, the different letters that appear, so M, D, A, et cetera, this I should say, is not the whole message. It went on for quite a while longer than this, but I didn't want to write it on the screen. If you look at the frequencies of every third letter, you'll find that it kind of matches, roughly speaking, the frequencies that you'd find for letters in English. Right? In English, some letters are much more common than others. Right? E is much more common than Q. Although when you work in quantum computing, like I do, Q shows up an awful lot. Anyway, playing around with those frequencies, it didn't match exactly the frequencies of English because, you know, different English sentences will have different letters appear with different frequencies. I was able to find that there was a pattern that I could decipher, and that if I took the first letter and the fourth letter and the seventh letter and so on and shifted it by 14, and then I shifted the second letter and fifth letter, et cetera, by 19 letters, and the third letter, sixth letter, et cetera, if I shifted it by one, I got something that made sense. As Gregor Samsa woke one morning from uneasy dreams, et cetera. So I don't know why they had this on their wall, but you know, no accounting for taste. So anyway, so like I said, I was sitting in this room for a while, and I actually had some explanation to give of this thing. So this is an example of private key cryptography. Right? Get it carried away with the anecdote and forget to tell you the cryptography. Sorry. So this is an example of private key cryptography. So private key cryptography is kind of maybe the standard thing one thinks of when you think of secret codes. And the idea is that you have two people, Alice and Bob, who want to communicate secretly. So Alice wants to send a message to Bob, but there's some eavesdropper, frequently called Eve, down here, who wants to listen in and find out what the secret message is. So Alice and Bob have to have some advantage over Eve, or there's no way they can communicate secretly. And in this case, what's called private key cryptography, or symmetric cryptography, they share some secret key. Okay? When Alice wants to encode a message, she uses the secret key and sends it through some process, encrypts it, and then sends it to Bob over some communications channel. Now, it may be that Eve is listening in this communications channel, right? If Alice sends an email, maybe Eve is, it hops through the internet, and Eve is controlling one of those intermediate nodes and can read the email. But because it's encrypted and she doesn't know what the key is, Eve can't actually read the message. She can just see the ciphertext, the encrypted part. She can't see what it actually says. But Bob does know the key, so he knows how to undo what Alice did and read the original message, right? So in this poster I showed you from before, here's the ciphertext up here, M, Z, F, D, et cetera. And it's very common in codes to break up the words instead of, you know, having two letters and then six letters and so on, which would give you some information about what's going on, just to break them up into sets of five. But then the key is the numbers 14, 19, 1, right? And if you know 14, 19, 1, then you know how to decode this message very easily, right? Because you shift the first letter by 14 and the second letter by 19, the third letter by 1, and so on. Fourth letter by 14, and start repeating, okay? But now you can already see that this is not a very secure code. That's why I was able to break it with pencil and paper. Because there is a pattern that's left over, right? Which is that every third letter gets shifted by the same amount. And therefore, the frequency of the letters, every third letter, is going to match the frequency of the letters, every third letter in the original message. Right? But you can imagine that if that key got longer and longer, it would be harder and harder to see for two reasons. First, there would be more things to figure out, right? If it were a six-number key instead of a three-number key, then there would be twice as much information to figure out to find the key. But second of all, there would be less pattern to work on, right? Because instead of having one-third of the letters to look at the frequency of, you have only one-sixth of the letters. And as the key gets longer and longer and longer, the patterns kind of disappear. There's less and less information to work with, and it gets harder and harder to break. And it turns out that if you take the extreme version of this and take a key that's as long as the message, it's not just hard to break, it's actually impossible to break. So this is called the one-time pad. So the way that works is you have a message, which you know might as well encode it in binary, since we're going to use computers nowadays to do this anyway. So we have a message which might be 0000011001, et cetera. And we have a key which is just a sequence of random bits. Okay, 00101, et cetera. And then to encrypt the message, we're going to line them up. And if the key is 0, we're going to use the message bit for the ciphertext. And if the key is 1, we're going to use the other bit, the opposite, the not of the message bit for the ciphertext. And so that's what I've done here. Okay? And the point is that if you don't know the key, you can't get any useful information from the ciphertext at all. Because it's just as likely, if you look somewhere in the middle, say, that this 0 came because the key was 0 and the message was 0, as when the message was 1 and the key was 1. Right? And because these key bits are never reused, there's no way to get further information that will tell you what that bit was. Okay? So the one-time pad is not just, as I said, really secure, it's completely secure. If you don't have the key, there's no way you can get any information about the message. Okay, so that's a really great cryptographic system. And if that were all there was to it, the sort of, in fact, people do use this one-time pad, but it has some disadvantages. So first of all, as I said, the key can only be used once. And actually, there have been examples in history where people accidentally used a one-time pad twice. And that was already enough to allow people to break the message. The Soviet Union did this, and the US National Security Agency was actually able to decode a bunch of messages that Soviet agents sent. And the other thing is that you have to, Alice and Bob have to agree on this key ahead of time, right? And if they run out of key, they can't use it again, so they're going to have to get a new key. And you have to be very sure that when you get this new key from Alice to Bob, that nobody else has taken a look at it, right? Because the reason this is protected is because Eve doesn't know the secret key. If Eve somehow learns it, then she knows as much as Bob. So, I mean, you can do this by, you know, having some guy with a briefcase handcuffed to his arm and traveling from Alice to Bob to deliver a new secret key. But it's worth remembering that what's inside that briefcase is just random numbers. Okay? From a cryptographic point of view, those random numbers are really valuable. But, of course, they're also kind of meaningless. Okay. So now back to the anecdote. So, like I said, I've been sitting in this room for a while. I deciphered this poster. And eventually, a woman came in. She said, I'm sorry we've had to keep you waiting. My name is Alice. I'm afraid we're not quite ready for you. So if you can be patient, wait a little bit longer, we'll get you in a little bit. So I was, by this time, a little upset that I had been, you know, kind of whisked away in this mysterious manner and didn't know what was going on or anything. So I said, well, can you at least tell me what's going on? And she said, no, I'm afraid we'll get to that later. And, you know, I was, at that point, I didn't have this BlackBerry. This was before I worked at Perimeter. So I was kind of desperate to get in touch with the outside world. So I said, well, can I at least have a computer or something so I can check email? And she said, yes, I'm sure we can arrange that. So she went out. A few minutes later, some men came in, wheeled in a computer. For some reason, they also changed the poster on the wall. Anyway, so they set up the computer. I was not interested in the poster at that point. I set to work on the computer. And checked my email. So that was fine. But then when I tried to send an email, the computer crashed. Okay. That was annoying. So I rebooted it, tried again. Again, it crashed. Okay. I found, you know, knocked on the door, door was locked, tried to get out, no one answering. So I kind of at a loss for what to do, I decided to turn my attention back to this poster. And the poster made even less sense than the previous one, if possible. So the previous poster, remember, was blocks of letters, five letters. This new poster was just large hexadecimal numbers. Okay, which after puzzling over for a minute or so, I realized must be another code. I mean, it didn't seem sensible to just put totally random numbers and letters up on the poster. And I suspected, in fact, that this was what's called an example of what's called RSA. So RSA is a more recent code than the one-time pad. It's an example of what's called public key cryptography. So what is public key cryptography? So remember, in the previous example, like the one-time pad, Alice and Bob shared a key. And they used the same key to encode the message and decode the message. So in public key cryptography, that's not what happens. In public key, there's one message that's used to encode and a different message that's used to decode. So the key that's used to encode is called the private key. And Alice keeps that. And then there's a public code, a public key that's used to decode. And Alice sends that out. And she can send it to everyone she knows, to Bob, to Carly, et cetera. Even Eve can get a copy of the public key. You see here, the public key is in gray. And Alice keeps her private key. So the private key has to be protected. She keeps that very secret. And she knows the private key. OK, so once she sends out these public keys, well, then anyone who wants can communicate with her secretly. So the idea is that, say, Charlie wants to send a message here to Alice. So he uses the public key to encrypt the message and then sends it to Alice. And Eve might listen in, and she might see this encrypted message. She has the public key, but that's not enough to read the message. To read the message, you need the private key. And only Alice has, I thought there was another one. No, I guess not. OK. Only Alice has the private key. So only Alice can actually read this message. OK? So in particular, here's how RSA works. So in RSA, the public key, the one that's used to encrypt, is two big numbers, which I'll call N and E. And by big, I mean really big, like 300 digits long. Okay? So you wouldn't want to have to work with these numbers by hand. Your computer, though, can do a lot of manipulations with them pretty fast. And so to encrypt a message, suppose Bob wants to send Alice a message. So he wants to send the message M. So what he's going to do is he's going to convert the message to some numerical form. And in particular, it has to be numbers less than N. So this may mean that he has to break it up into chunks and send each chunk to send part of the information. And then next segment of information, he does this whole procedure again. So he has some number less than n, so we'll assume that m is less than n. And then what he does is he raises it raises m, the number, to the power e. Okay? And then divides by n and takes the remainder. So mathematically, we write that this way, y equals m to the e mod n. Okay? And then the private key is just another number, d. And d is related to n and e. And in fact, it's related to e through the prime factorization of n. So the assumption here, and to make this system work right, you pick an n that's a product of two very big prime numbers. Okay? And multiplying these prime numbers together to get n, that's a pretty easy thing to do. But going backwards, that's very hard. Right? I mean, n is 300 digits long, right? And so it's the product of two primes that are about 150 digits long. If you had to try every prime up to 150 digits, well, that would take a ridiculous amount of time, right? 10 to the 150 is a very big number. Now, there's much better ways to factor numbers, but still nothing we know of that will work on a regular computer like this and take any kind of reasonable amount of time. So, I didn't finish RSA. So to decrypt, then, so D is chosen specifically to relate to these prime factors of n, and has the property that Alice can decrypt by getting the message from Bob, y, remember that's encrypted, and then she raises it to the power d. And d is chosen so that when she n divides by n takes the remainder. And d is chosen so that when she does that, she gets back the original message m. Okay? So public key up there, private key here. And this is a system that's really very widely used today. It's used when you go on the web and try to buy something. The system uses RSA to communicate securely, so that there's no eavesdropper can read your credit cards, for instance. So as you can imagine, I looked at this poster and said, well, if it's RSA, I'm not really going to be able to break it. So I couldn't repeat the game I played with the previous poster. So I went back to the computer and kind of poked around to see if there was anything else interesting on it or something to do. Any games? I don't know. I had to pass the time somehow. And I didn't find any games, but I did find a directory that had some programs in it. One of them was named shore.exe. So I don't know, that most people that might not mean anything, but since I work in the field of quantum information, Peter Shor is one of our best-known researchers, probably the best-known researcher in the field. And he's best known because he discovered an algorithm that would factor large numbers. Okay? And remember that this RSA public key crypto system is based on factoring numbers being hard. If you could factor this number n, then you could work out what d is from n and e. And so if you had a copy of the public key, you could find the private key, and therefore you could read the messages. So of course, this is a really big deal. If you can break RSA, widely used today, it would definitely affect the world we live in. However, there's a catch, which is that Shor's algorithm only runs on a quantum computer. Right? And I guess you've been to IQC on Monday, was it? And so you've seen some quantum computers and heard some more about quantum computers. So why don't I tell you, or at least review what they are. So anyway, so a quantum computer works using quantum information. So quantum information, if you have very, very small objects, like atoms, will behave in a quantum mechanical way, as you've been hearing about. And classical information, we think of as having two values, usually, right? 0 and 1. And then that's a bit. And then you can put together lots of bits to make any message you want. So quantum information, the main unit, is a qubit, a quantum bit. And quantum bits can be in superposition. So in some sense, they can be in 0 or 1, but they can also be in a superposition state, like this one, 3/5 0 plus 4/5 1. And so in some sense, that's both things at once. But in some sense, it's only one of 0 or 1. Because if you look at it, if you measure it, it'll collapse. And you'll get, in this particular case, you'll get 0 with a probability 9/25 and 1 with a probability 16/25, the square of these amplitudes. And the reason that quantum information is interesting and different from regular information, or classical information, if you like to call it, is that these different possibilities, it's not just that you measure them and you get something random. That wouldn't be all that interesting. But that these different possibilities can interfere with each other in interesting ways, constructive or destructive interference. So anyway, so when we put a bunch of these qubits together, we can imagine making a device that will manipulate them. And that's the quantum computer that you saw at IQC. The idea is that it would manipulate these qubits just in the same way that a classical computer manipulates bits, but it would also be able to take advantage of the superposition that you find in quantum mechanics. So up here at the top is something that a classical computer could do. It could flip a bit, right? It could send 0 to 1 or vice versa. But for a quantum computer to work, you also have to be able to create superpositions and destroy superpositions. So for instance, there's an operation called the Hadamard transform. And the Hadamard transform will take a qubit that starts at 0 and put it in a superposition of 0 plus 1. And this 1 over square root of 2 is to get the probabilities right. So if you measure it, you get a half probability of 0 and a half probability of 1. And the Hadamard transform has to do something different on 1, but it still takes it to a superposition. It takes it to a superposition 0 minus 1. Right? And the quantum mechanical operations will not erase information, usually. If you haven't, you can maybe shunt it into another system and then ignore that system or throw it away. But if you have a closed system, they have to be reversible. So the thing that this Hadamard transform does to 0 has to be different from the thing that it does to 1. And the difference here is in this phase. So there's a really big difference. Even though if you take this state and you measure it, half the time you'll get 0 and half the time you'll get 1. And the same thing happens if you measure this state. Half the time you get 0, half the time you get 1. There's still a very big difference between them. And that difference is 100% in this plus sign versus minus sign. So it's a really very important part of quantum mechanics, that there's different kinds of superposition. OK, so of course, if this was all your quantum computer could do, it wouldn't be very interesting. You just have a single qubit. So we also need operations that interact multiple qubits. And those will work on superpositions as well. So, for instance, this is just a this is what the example I've written here. The computer will look in a kind of coherent way. So it's not really measuring, but it'll take these first and third qubits, and if they're both 1, it'll flip the second qubit. So that only happens here, and so this one becomes 1, 1, 1, and these all stay the same. And then in this operation, we're going to follow that by switching the second and third qubit. And so this 1, 1, 1 stays 1, 1, 1. This 1, 1, 0 becomes 1, 0, 1. And these two things stay the same. And you'll notice that if we had different amplitudes in superposition, A, B, C, D, they follow the paths of these classical bit strings. Okay? So you can using this, you can build up a quantum computer that can do anything that's allowed by quantum mechanics. It can convert any quantum state into any other quantum state. Of course, something that you try to do might take a really long time, a lot of basic operations. But in principle, you can change the state any way you like. I mean, I haven't shown you the full set of things you need to do that, but using operations much like the ones I've shown. Okay? Okay, so I mentioned interference before, and I thought I'd show you a concrete example of how that works in the quantum computer. So suppose you have one of these superposition states, 0 plus 1 over the square root of 2, and you try to do one of these Hadamard transforms, right? That's the thing that creates a superposition. It takes a 0 to 0 plus 1 and a 1 to 0 minus 1. Well, it turns out that there's a very simple calculation you can do to see what the answer is. You just take this 0, and remember, 0 goes to 0 plus 1. It went to 0 plus 1 over root 2. We already have another root 2, so it goes to 0 plus 1 over 2. And the 1, remember, goes to 0 minus 1 over root 2. Again, we have the root 2 down here, so the 1, in this case, will go to 0 minus 1 over 2. And we have the plus up there, so we add these together. So we get 0 over 2 plus 0 over 2, that's 0. And 1 over 2 minus 1 over 2. So that's just gone. OK? So by doing this Hadamard transform on the superposition state, we've ended up with one of the original basis states. Okay? One of the classical bit strings, or in this case, just a bit. So this is an example both of constructive interference and destructive interference. Right? The zero terms here add constructively to give you something, and the one terms cancel out. And so the ones are gone. And it may not be obvious, but this is actually just an example of the double slit experiment phrased in quantum information language. Okay? You have kind of the zero and one say whether it went through the first slit or the second slit. And then this interference here is the constructive interference of the bright points on the screen, and the destructive or the dark points. Okay. So anyway, so that's what a quantum computer does. I mean, I guess you've heard some version of this before. But how does that relate to factoring large numbers? Well, I'm not going to go through the details of this algorithm. But the idea of Shor's algorithm is that, well, already using classical number theory, you can derive a fact that factoring large numbers, if you want to factor large numbers, is sufficient to be able to find the period of some particular function. So in particular, I want to find the period of this modular exponentiation function, the one that I use in RSA. Right? You take some number, you raise it to a power, and take the remainder mod n. And if you keep doing this, there's only so many numbers less than n, right? So eventually you have to get back to where you started. Right? And if you keep on multiplying, suppose you take the number x, right, and you raise it to the power a, and eventually you get back to where you started. And if you multiply by x more, so you're raising higher and higher powers of x, you get back again and again and again. And the time it takes you to get back is always the same, right? Because well, you're multiplying by x each time, and you're just repeating what you did before. So that modular exponentiation is a periodic function. And if you can figure out how long it takes to get back to where you started, what the period is, it turns out that that's enough to factor n. So that's what Shor's algorithm does. It figures out what that period is. So the way this works is you create a superposition state. Okay, and you create a superposition over x raised to different powers. And because that function, x to the power a, is periodic, the superposition state will be basically a periodic function. It'll be a sum of peaks in different positions. Now, you don't know exactly where it starts. Okay, so that's a little complication. But you don't really care where it starts. All you want to know is the distance between the peaks. Okay? If you were just to measure it right now and see where a peak is, that wouldn't be very helpful. Because you don't, like I said, you don't know where it starts. But if you can do some quantum thing, you'll be able to figure out the period. And the way that works is using something called the Fourier transform. So the Fourier transform is a mathematical function, but it's actually familiar to all of you. You do it all the time. Your ear does it, in fact. When you hear sound, your ear decomposes that sound. Sound is really vibrations in the air, right? But when you hear it, you hear frequencies. And those frequencies are the period of those vibrations. Okay? So what we need to do is we need to do this Fourier transform on the quantum state. And there's a little quantum algorithm that will do this, a quantum computer program, that will do this, and it will extract the period of this function, the frequency. Okay? And then once we know the frequency, we can factor the number. So back to the anecdote. So it seemed unlikely that this was a quantum computer, but I figured I might as well play around. I did notice there was some kind of funny black box sticking out of the back of the computer, so I figured it was worth a try. So I started this Shor.exe program and plugged in the numbers that were on the poster, and indeed, it managed to factor them and break the numbers. So here's what it did. It said, by finding the period of taking powers mod n, that allows us to factor n. And it spit out the factors of n. And then using another little program on the computer, I was able to deduce what the decryption key for n was. That just used a regular classical program. And then from that, I was able to decode the message. Someone must have been telling lies about Joseph K. Without having done anything wrong, he was arrested one fine morning, etc. As you can imagine, this didn't make me feel all that great, considering the situation I was in. Yeah. Well, this was the computer they provided to me, right? When I asked for the email, it had some weird black box stuck in the back. That must have been the quantum processor. So I don't know where they got it. They never really explained that, but... Okay, so so I decrypted this message, and then I had to sit for a little while longer. Eventually, Alex, by then fairly upset, and started, you know, kind of gesticulating and insisting that she tell me what was going on. She politely but firmly, unfortunately, refused to tell me, and explained that I was going to have to wait a little bit while longer. So I complained about the computer crashing when I tried to send email. She said, okay, we'll send some people to fix it. She went out, people came back in, did some stuff with the computer. I don't know, they also took down the poster, by the way. I guess it had served its purpose. It didn't seem like they really did much with the computer, but they, you know, plugged some more cables back in the back. Maybe that would solve the problem. And then they left. So, got on the computer again, tried to send an email. Again, it crashed. No luck. So, I was stuck there. Not even another new poster had gone up to give me something to do. So I had no choice but to poke around more on the computer. And I found that these new cables that they had plugged in had messages going back and forth. And looking at them, they seemed to be even single photon messages, as well as a number of classical bit strings. So given that what I experienced so far, they had a, you know, kind of insecure message on a poster, and then a much more secure one that was still breakable with a quantum computer. So I thought maybe this was even more secure cryptography that was getting piped through my computer for some reason. And in particular, I thought it might be an example of quantum key distribution. So imagine you saw quantum key distribution devices at ITC. Yes? Yes. Okay. But I'll explain again how it works. So the idea of quantum key distribution is that, remember, I talked about the one-time pad before. And Alice and Bob share this long secret key that's as long as the message they want to send. They can communicate with absolute security. They don't have to worry about somebody with a really big computer breaking the code at all. And so the idea of QKD, quantum key distribution, is to distribute those secret keys without having to send some guy with a briefcase handcuffed to his arm. And they do that by sending photons from Alice to Bob and using the properties of quantum mechanics to make sure there's no eavesdropper. So in particular, there's four possible photon states that Alice might send. So she makes a choice. She wants to send either a Z state or an X state. That's just random. And then for each of these, she can send something that's going to correspond to the key bit 0, and another one that's going to correspond to the key bit 1. So if she wants to set up the first bit of her key with Bob to be a 0, she's going to send one of these two states. And if she wants to send the first bit to be 1, she's going to send one of these two. Okay? And so these states, these Z states, you might think of, I've written them as 0 and 1, kind of the quantum computer language of a qubit. But physically, they might be, say, polarization of light. So 0 could be vertical polarization, sitting up and down, and 1 would be horizontal polarization. And then these states, these superposition states, for the X states, they could be diagonal polarization. So the 0 plus 1 might be diagonal this way, and 0 minus 1 is diagonal this way. Okay? And as I mentioned before, and as you've heard before, if you measure one of these superposition states in the original basis, you'll get a random result. So that's going to be a complication for a quantum key distribution. And Bob has a choice of whether he wants to measure in the horizontal vertical basis, the Z basis, or in the diagonal basis, the X basis. And if he chooses the wrong one, he's just going to get a random result. He's not going to get the key bit that Alice sent. Right? So if Alice sent 0 plus 1 over root 2, the X basis state corresponding to 1, but Bob measured it as if it were a Z state, Well, then half the time he'll get 0, half the time he'll get 1, even though Alice wanted to set up the key bit 0. Okay? So the solution to this problem is that Alice will send a whole bunch of things, and then Bob will measure them. He'll make his decisions about what to measure. But then they'll only keep the ones where they measure the same thing. So to do that, of course, we'll have to announce what basis they each used, whether Alice sent the X or the Z state, an X or a Z state, and whether Bob made an X measurement or a Z measurement. So I'll get back to the details of how that works in a moment. But the upshot is that they'll only be able to keep about half the bits that Alice sent. It's kind of inconvenient, but you know, it's the price you pay, I guess, for perfect secrecy. Okay, so where does the eavesdropper come in here? Well, suppose the eavesdropper wants to learn what the key bit is. The thing is, she's in the same situation as Bob, right? She doesn't know which kind of state Alice sends, whether it was an X state or a Z state. And so she also has to guess what measurement to make. And suppose she guesses, if she guesses right, she'll learn what the key bit is. And then she knows what that particular key bit is. But if she guesses wrong, well, she has first of all, she has a random result. And second of all, she could introduce an error. How does that work? Well, suppose Alice sent this 0 state. So that was in the Z basis, right, a 0 key. But Eve guessed maybe it's an X basis state. So she measures in the diagonal basis, the X basis, and she gets some result. Say it's 0 plus 1. Okay? And then she passes that on to Bob, right, because that's her best guess for what the state is. She doesn't know that it was really a 0. And then Bob happens to measure this in the Z basis. So this is a bit that Alice and Bob are going to keep because they agreed on what basis to use. So Bob happens to measure in the Z basis, but Eve actually sent the superposition state, which means that half the time Bob will indeed get 0, which is what Alice sent, but half the time he's going to get 1. Right? And 1 is wrong. 1 is not what Alice sent, even though Alice and Bob were using the same basis. Okay? So the problem is that Eve's making the measurements in here has disturbed the state. It's changed the information being sent. And there's just no way, it turns out, that Eve can learn about what the key bits are without making some mistakes, without introducing errors into the system. So if Alice and Bob do a little bit of comparison, they can find out that there are errors and detect that Eve is eavesdropping. Okay? So here's the full quantum key distribution protocol. So Alice is going to choose a random set of bits that she wants to send and a random choice of basis, X or Z, in which to send them. Yeah? Right. Yeah, I mean, this message is just a bunch of random bits. And some of those random bits will be different when Bob receives them than the ones that Alice sent. Okay? Of course, I should say, it's relevant down here, is that in a real system, there will always be some error, right, even if there's no eavesdropper. And so Alice and Bob have to be able to tolerate a little bit of error. But if there's too many errors, they'll say, oh, there must be an eavesdropper listening, or there might be an eavesdropper listening. And therefore, we can't be sure the system is safe. So anyway, here's the whole thing they do. Alice will choose this random set of bits in X or Z basis. She'll make the corresponding qubits, photons, for instance, send them to Bob. And then Alice and Bob have to do a whole bunch of talking, regular classical communication, in order to actually take these photons and convert them into a secret key. So Bob, remember, is measuring these things in his own random choice of basis, X or Z. So Alice and Bob will announce what X and Z bases they use for each one. Right? So for the first one, Alice might say, I sent an X state. And Bob said, oh, I measured a Z state. So they'll discard a bit where they have different things. But if the next one, Alice says, I sent X, and Bob says, I measured X, then they'll keep that one. Okay? And they'll go through and announce all of them. And the important thing is that they're not doing this announcing until after Bob has received the photons. Okay? And that means it's too late. Eve will now find out what basis Alice used. If she had known that before, she could have eavesdropped. But it's too late for her now, okay? She's already had her chance to make a measurement, and it's passed. She had to send the photons back onto Bob. Okay? So And if she did try to make a measurement, then she would have introduced errors. And her opportunity to change those is gone. So anyway, so once they've done that, they have to try to figure out whether there is an eavesdropper to look at the error rate by looking at the error rate. So they do that by choosing some subset of these bits to use as a test. And Alice will announce what her values were for those bits. Bob will announce what his values were for those bits. And they'll see how often they disagree. Right? That'll tell them what the error rate is, roughly speaking. If they've chosen these things at random, it should give them a good idea of what the error rate is on the whole set. Of course, the ones they've announced, they're not going to be able to use in the secret key. So they're going to have to throw those out. But the ones that they didn't announce, those are still secret. So if they deduce the error rate and it's too high, they say, there might be an eavesdropper. We have to stop. If it's low, then they can do some procedures to fix up the remaining bits. There might still be some errors, so they use some error correcting code. And kind of shuffle them around to exclude any additional information that Eve might still have, any little bit. And at the end of this procedure, they end up with a secret key that should be perfectly secure. Okay? And then they can use the secret key in the one-time pad or any other cryptographic system. And if it's the one-time pad, they can be confident. Eve doesn't know the key. The one-time pad can't be broken. So they know it's safe. Okay? So where did this leave me? I mean, I was sitting in this room. The code going through seemed to be quantum key distribution. There were additional messages, which I assumed were the encrypted messages with the key that they were creating. But surely I had no hope of breaking this, right? Quantum key distribution is secure. I mean, we can actually prove, mathematically prove, that if it's implemented correctly, it's secure. But actually, looking more closely at what they were doing, I decided maybe they weren't implementing it correctly. There was a flaw in what they were doing. So here's what it was. And here's how I was able to break this system, ultimately. So what I noticed was that Alice was sending her qubits to Bob, and then they were starting to compare. But they were not doing any checking that they were actually talking to the right people. So here's what I could do. Alice sent along these qubits. They went through my computer, and then I intercepted them. Okay, here I'm playing the role of Eve. And when I was talking to Alice, I pretended to be Bob. So Alice sent the qubits, and I told Alice, yes, I've received the qubits and I've measured them. And Alice said, oh, I sent an X basis, a Z basis, Z, 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 etc. And I, pretending to be Bob, said, oh, I measured Z, 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 X, etc. Which I actually did. I just behaved exactly like Bob would have. And Alice then very happily went through the rest of the procedure. In this case, the first bit, we disagreed on the basis, so we threw it out. The second key bit, we agreed on, so we kept it. The third one, we kept, etc. We went through this whole procedure, and we established a shared secret key. And then Alice sent her encrypted message using this shared secret key. But the thing is, it wasn't a secret key that was shared between Alice and Bob. It was a secret key that was shared between Alice and me. And so, of course, I had the secret key. I was able to read the message she sent. And I knew what it said. And more than that, I to make sure that they didn't know anything mischievous was going on, I talked to Bob. And when I talked to Bob, I pretended to be Alice. So I sent some qubits from the quantum computer, more photons, sent them on to Bob. And Bob said, yes, I've received them. I said, oh, I sent X, X, Z, Z, et cetera. Bob said, oh, well, I measured Z, X, Z, X, et cetera. And we compared, we discarded bits, we did error correcting codes, et cetera. We got a secret key. And then I used that secret key to encrypt the message I had received from Alice and send it on to Bob. Bob was perfectly happy. He had a secret key. He thought he was sharing it with Alice. He was able to decrypt the message, got the message that Alice sent. So they thought they were communicating perfectly secretly. But actually, they weren't, because Alice thought she was communicating with Bob, she was really communicating with me. Bob thought he was communicating with Alice, was really communicating with me. Okay? So here's what the message said. So I thought they must have surely been doing something serious while I was sitting here waiting, but I guess they were actually playing a game. So anyway, so how can you fix this quantum key distribution system? Is it always vulnerable to this man-in-the-middle attack, where Eve can pretend to be Bob when talking to Alice and pretend to be Alice when talking to Bob? And the answer is no. There is a solution to this. And the idea is that Alice and Bob have to authenticate the messages they send, so that you need something that Alice knows that she's really talking to Bob, and Bob knows that she's really talking to Alice. So if they have a little bit of shared private key to start with, then there's a method, a classical cryptographic method that will let them be sure that the messages they send are really coming from the right people. So quantum key distribution, you can't start from nothing. But if you start with just a little bit of private key, then you can use quantum key distribution to get a lot more private key. Yeah. Authentication, yeah. It's similar to signature. I'll get to signatures in a moment. Basically, the signature is this plus a little bit more. But yes, for now, let's think of it like a signature. Alice and Bob want to sign their messages so that the other one knows that it really came from them. Okay? And I should say that, I mean, the quantum computer, that's kind of science fiction-y at the moment. I mean, you saw the state of the art, I guess, at ITC a few days ago. But QKD is actually practical, and there's even companies that are selling it today. Okay. So, sorry, this is more anecdote first. Okay, so I deciphered this message. And ultimately, then I was kind of out of stuff to do, and I started to wait around for a while. But ultimately, Alice came back, and she said, before I was able to introduce any more objections, she said, "It turns out we don't need you after all. You can go." Well, I was, of course, a little upset that I had been left here for all this time, and then, you know, they let me out without saying anything. But I was afraid to make too much of a ruckus for fear that they wouldn't let me out. But I said, "Well, okay, but can you at least tell me what this was all about?" And she said, no, I'm afraid we can't. But I'll tell you what, we may be in touch with you in the future, and perhaps then I can explain." So as I left, she gave me kind of a small box, kind of a crystal thing. It looked like there might be some particles embedded in it. And of course, I tried to slip this black box from the back of the computer into my pocket as I left. And that was it. I went home. I was kind of curious as to what this thing that she gave me was. It was, like I said, a crystal with some particles embedded in it. So I went to some of my experimentalist friends, and they examined it. And they said, "Yes, I think there's some quantum particles embedded in here, quantum spins." And thinking about what she'd said, that she'd be in touch, I thought maybe this was a way she had of identifying herself. This is where the signature is going to come in. So how would these quantum particles help in identifying herself? Well, it turns out there's a way you can hide information in quantum states. And it's kind of accessible, but kind of not accessible. So here's how that works. Well, if you have a single bit, it has two possible values, right, 0 or 1. And if you look at the bit, you measure it, you find out which one it was. But a qubit has many possible values, right? So here are some examples: 0, 1, 0 plus 1 or 0 minus 1, 3 fifths 0 plus 4 fifths 1, or 4 fifths 0 minus 3 fifths 1. And there's, of course, many, many more possible values. There's an infinite set of values, in fact. Of course, as these numbers get very, very close, they become very, very similar states. But these are all fairly dissimilar. Okay, and if somebody gives you this qubit, there's no way you can tell which of these states you have. You can get some information. You can tell if it's a 0 or if it's a 1. But there's no way to tell, for instance, if it's a 0 or a 0 plus 1. Those states are not sufficiently different. But if you have this state and somebody tells you it's a 0 plus 1, you can check that. And the reason is that you can make a measurement that will distinguish between 0 plus 1 and 0 minus 1, using this Hadamard transform I mentioned before. And if it's a 0 minus 1 state, you'll always find a 0 minus 1. If it's a 0 plus 1, you'll always find a 0 plus 1. If it's some other state, if it's zero, say, then with some probability, in this case a half, you'll get 0 plus 1, and with some probability, a half, you'll get 0 minus 1. Okay? So if somebody pretends that they know what this state is, but they're wrong, then there's some probability that you'll find out that they're lying when you try to check them. Okay? So by giving me these spins, only Alice knows what they are. So if later she tries to identify herself, she can do that by saying the values of these spins. And if it's not really Alice, I would be able to check that, right? Okay, so another interesting property of these quantum states is that even though we can't tell whether they're a specific value, we can check whether two spins are the same. And we can do that by doing something called the swap test. So suppose we're given a spin. We don't know whether it's 0 or 0 plus 1 or 3 fifths 0 plus 4 fifths 1, et cetera. And we have another spin. And we'd like to know whether they're the same or not. Well, we can check whether they're the same by taking the first spin and the second spin and switching them. Okay? We have to do this in a special quantum way to make sure the information about how this works is well, that's a detail I won't go into. But if they really are the same quantum state, then nothing changes, right? We get exactly the state we started with. But if they're different quantum states, even if not completely distinguishable like this, so 0 plus 1 versus 1, then when we swap them, there is something that changes. It's a different state. It's not completely different because there's kind of some component of 1 up here already. And that component doesn't change. This is 0, 1 plus 1, 1. But some part does change. And so by making the appropriate measurements, we can tell whether something has changed or not. And we can tell whether these spins are really the same or not. There's some randomness. We don't get the answer with 100% probability, but we get some information. And this turned out to be useful to me, because I talked to a bunch of my colleagues in the field, and it turned out that a number of them had similar experiences. And so one thing we were interested in is whether there were, you know, multiple groups doing this, whisking people off and having them sit in rooms, or whether it was really the same person. And they had each gotten you know, a crystal box like me, and with some spins embedded in it. So what we decided to do is to do this swap test. We took the spins that I had and the spins that they had and did a swap test between them. And it turned out that they were the same. Okay? So that really strongly implied that it was the same person behind it, right? Because only Alice, presumably, knew what those spins were that she gave to me, and presumably only the person who gave them to my colleague knew what those spins were. And so they wouldn't randomly be the same thing, and nor would anybody have an opportunity to create that set of spins unless they knew that they were the same. Okay. So sometime later, a year or two later, I actually did get a message from Alice. The message came with instructions as how to verify that it really came from Alice. And the idea was I was supposed to take this crystal box and measure the spins in it according to the procedure that she set. So as I've described already, if she identifies what the spins are, that that will prove that it's really her, right? Because only she knows what they are. And I can check that that's the correct identification of the spins. But more than that, I can check that the message is really the message that she sent, and it hasn't been altered by somebody else. So how does that work? Well, it breaks down to one bit at a time from her message. And what she does is divides all the spins in the system in half. Says these are the spins that are going to be used to verify the zero message, and these are the ones that are going to be used to verify one message. And for zero message, she reveals the state of half of the spins, half of the qubits, okay, the zero half. And if she wants to assign a one message, she reveals the states in the other half, the one half. Okay, and I of course can check that what the spins that she's revealing, the values that she's revealing, are correct. And when she wants to send a, you know, multi-bit message, she has to use more qubits to do that. So the point is that when Alice reveals the zero, Well, anybody who has these set of spins can verify that it really came from her. But we still don't know what the spins are for the one message. So even though I could read her message, I couldn't change it. Right? So I know that it really came from her, and it's really the message that she sent. So here's what it said. So she was asking me to do something. I've omitted it here, because if I told you, you would not believe me. Well, given everything that's happened in the subsequent years, maybe you would believe me. But certainly, I wouldn't want to make an accusation like this without proof. After all, I really do have no proof, right? I mean, for all you know, I could be making this all up. But wait a second. Maybe I do have proof, right? Because I got this message, and I had a bunch of colleagues who also had the same experience, right? And I could use these spins to verify that the message really came from Alice. They had the same spins. I already checked that. So they should be able to do the same thing, too, right? So I should at least be able to get my colleagues on my side and conclude that this message with this mission really got sent from this mysterious person, that it wasn't just an invention from my own mind. And that's because this protocol that I've been describing is, in fact, a digital signature. So how does that differ from just authentication? Well, in a digital signature, multiple people can verify the message. So in particular, digital signature is, again, what's called the public key protocol. So it uses a public key and a private key. But in this case, the public key is used to verify messages, and the private key is used to sign messages. So the private key, in the thing I've shown you so far, is Alice's knowledge of what all the spins are in the box. And the public key is, in this case, the quantum spins themselves. Okay? So the idea in a digital signature is Alice gives out copies of her public key to anyone she might want to sign a message to. And then when she wants to sign a message, she sends it to Bob and uses her private key to sign it. Bob has some procedure that takes the signed message and the public key and verifies that it really came from Alice. And so he can conclude that, yes, it's an authentic message. So that part is just authentication. The signature comes in because Bob can then relay this signed message to Charlie and say, look at this message I got from Alice. And Charlie, he has the same public key, so he can verify, yes, this message really did come from Alice. The point is that if they used a private key here, Bob had the same private key as Alice, this wouldn't work, right? Because Bob could make up a new message and pretend it was written by Alice and send it to Charlie. And Charlie would have no way of knowing whether it was really Alice that came up with the message or Bob came up with the message. But because this is an asymmetric protocol where the key used to sign messages is different from the one used to verify, only Alice knows how to sign messages. Okay? So that's the situation we had here. I could take this message that I got from Alice and send it on to my colleagues. And they would know that I didn't make it up because I didn't know what the spins were, right? I just had them. I didn't know their original values. Only Alice knew that. So only Alice could have made this signed message. Or so I thought. Turns out Alice had been a little more clever than that. There's a way to cheat this protocol that I showed you. So you can make digital signature protocols, I should say, already classically using RSA and other crypto systems. The problem with RSA, of course, is broken by a quantum computer. But that's not relevant to this particular part of the story. So how did Alice cheat? Well, I thought she was really giving us individual spins, but it turns out she wasn't. She was doing something more clever. She was giving us entangled states. Okay? I guess you heard about entanglement on Monday or maybe in previous lectures. But the idea is that the state she distributed, in this case, to two people, Bob and Charlie, is instead of being one spin for Bob and a separate copy of the same spins to Charlie, she sent a state that's correlated between them. In particular, it's a superposition of two possibilities. In one possibility, Bob had the zero spin and Charlie had the one spin. And the other possibility, Bob had the one spin and Charlie had the zero spin. Okay? And the thing is that if you do the swap test on this entangled state, nothing changes. Okay, because 0, 1 becomes 1, 0, and 1, 0 becomes 0, 1. So 0, 1 plus 1, 0 becomes 1, 0 plus 0, 1, But that's the same. The plus doesn't care what side it's on. So the swap leaves the state alone. Yeah? That's right. Alice doesn't want anyone to forge her signature, but she also, in this particular case, wanted me not to be able to prove to my colleagues that the message really came from her. She wanted to be able to deny that she really signed it. Yeah?
How is she keeping her signature secret?
How is... She keeps the private key secret. What? So her knowledge of what the spins are. So in this case, she's giving up. By sending these entangled public keys, she's giving up some of her ability to really prove it came from her and to do all these other things. So when Alice starts to cheat, the protocol is not necessarily going to work for in all the other aspects.
But if she's possibly distributing her signature keys, can't someone hack those?
Oh, sorry. So why don't I answer that question after? Okay, that's a more involved answer for that. I mean, in the case of this particular anecdote, she physically gave me those keys, so I knew it really came from her. But you're right. In the regular cryptographic setting, that's a big issue. So I'll answer that later, though. Okay. So to finish the anecdote, so this state is invariant under the swap test. So we thought we had the same keys, and therefore we should get the same answer when we verified the message. But look what happens. If Alice says this key bit is a zero, Bob measures it, Charlie measures it, but they'll get different answers. Right? Either Bob will measure zero and Charlie will measure one. Bob will say, yes, the message really came from Alice. And Charlie will say, no, it didn't come from Alice. Or the other way around. And that's what happened to me. So I showed this message to my colleagues. They measured their spins, but they got different answers. They said, no, that's not from Alice. You're just making it up. Okay? So that's why I have no proof. Okay, so, however, this scheme can be fixed so that it really is a valid digital signature scheme. The idea of doing that is that instead of using just one spin to check a message, you use lots of spins. Okay? And the thing is, up here, Alice has no control over whether it's Bob that gets zero and Charlie that gets one, or the other way around. So, if you use many qubits to verify a single bit of the message, then on average, Bob and Charlie will get the same number of zeros and the same number of ones. Okay? They'll be, won't be exactly the same, but they'll be close. And so they'll reach basically the same answer. So if you do that, this is, in fact, a valid digital signature program protocol. It's kind of inconvenient because, first of all, it uses qubits for public keys, which is today not really a good option. And second of all, because it uses a lot of public key and they get used up. So it's not really a practical protocol. But it shows you that quantum mechanics can do something interesting in this area. OK, so that's the end of the anecdote and the end of the talk. I never really did hear from Alice again. Needless to say, I refused the mission. I guess I didn't mention that before. But I hope you've learned something about cryptography today. Right? So we have the classical cryptography with private key systems where Alice and Bob share the same secret key to encrypt and decrypt. Public key systems where Alice or Bob encrypts using the public key and Alice decrypts using the private key. But public key systems private key systems include absolutely secure things like the one-time pad. Public key systems like RSA are much more convenient because you can give out the public key and you don't have to be very careful about it. But RSA can be broken with a quantum computer. Quantum key distribution uses quantum states to securely distribute private keys that can be used, for instance, in the one-time pad. And then quantum states can do other cryptographic things like digital signatures. So thank you. I find that it's best to put up a disclaimer after this talk because occasionally people have gotten confused. This was not a real thing that happened to me, but hopefully it served its purpose. Thanks. Okay. Right. So we already had a question that I deferred. So the way RSA is used for digital signatures today is that there's these companies that act as something called a certificate authority. So your browser has, when you get it, it has a bunch of public keys already in it. Okay? But they're not public keys for everybody. They're just public keys for these main authorities. The companies, for instance, Certicom is an example. VeriSign. So when you log onto a website, say Amazon, Amazon will give you a public key. But how do you know it really came from Amazon? That's your question. And the answer is that Amazon went to VeriSign and said, I have this public key I'd like to give out to people. VeriSign, their business is to sign these public keys themselves to prove that they really came. So VeriSign verifies that it really is Amazon that's coming to them and that it really is Amazon's public key. And then VeriSign signs Amazon's public key using their public key. Okay? So then you go to Amazon, you get this public key, and you check that it's signed by VeriSign. And if it is, then you say, well, I assume VeriSign is doing their job properly, and that they check that it is really Amazon's public key. And so now I can use it securely. Now I know Amazon's public key, and I can communicate with them. If the companies are not doing their job, that's definitely a weak spot. Occasionally, you'll find a website that wants to use a lesser-known provider or even sign it themselves. So that is a weak spot if somebody wanted to break it that way. Yes?
How do you check that VeriSign really verifies the key?
Well, I have to trust them to do their job. And I assume that if they didn't do their job and it turned out that there were keys signed by VeriSign that were not from the people they said they were, that would be a big scandal. VeriSign, the company, would be destroyed. And So how do I know that I really have VeriSign's public key?
Yeah.
Right. So it has to start somewhere. In this case, when you get your browser, it has VeriSign public key already in it. So, of course, to get the browser, you have to do something. And how do you know that that has not been tampered with? And so eventually, you run out of things. And you have to actually either meet somebody in person or just trust that somebody has not tampered with something that you've got. Yeah? In companies. Probably not very common. I think my understanding is that the companies that are selling them actually have some people buying them. It's not a huge business at the moment. But my impression is that the companies that are buying them are not quite using them for lots of real messages today. They're just kind of experimenting with them to see if this is something that they want to use. Today's quantum key distribution systems have some pretty severe limitations. They can't send key all that fast, so they don't really send enough key to use for long messages encrypted using the one-time pad. And they're very limited in range, maybe to 100 kilometers or so. So, but there are situations where even that's enough. So. Yeah?
Kind of following the idea of company or whatever, the 530 to be some start. So if we had the ALS log, and we knew they were communicating quietly, privately,
right.
There was absolutely no way of breaking it, then we could with certainty say that at some point in time they had been contacted.
So there's a couple of things. So first of all, the assumptions here are backwards, right? There's no way we can really know that there's no way of breaking into the system, right? All we can say is that we can't see any way to break into the system. So it could be that they're authenticating their messages, but that the authentications don't mean anything, that they've just made up some key and they're ignoring that authentication part, right? So, or it could be that they do have a shared key, but they sent it over some unsecure line previously. It could be that they never met in person, but that there's some person that they both trust gave them a shared key that they can start to use. Or it could be that to start out with, they used classical digital signature, which might not be secure against a quantum computer, but it was at least good enough to get them started. Right? If we didn't have a quantum computer back then, we couldn't break it then, and so then now it's too late. So there's a lot of possibilities. Okay.
So are there applications of this
right. Okay. So certainly quantum gravity has to involve entangled states because it's quantum. And quantum systems, well, I mean, they always involve superposition and entanglement and so on. Specifically, the ideas of quantum information have, in fact, been used for this information loss problem. You've heard about this problem?
We actually haven't talked about it, so.
Okay, so maybe I should briefly explain what it is.
Please.
So, black holes, you know what black holes are, right? So, when something falls into a black hole, you normally think of it, it's gone. But Stephen Hawking found that it's not necessarily gone, that actually something comes out of the black hole. Black holes radiate. And so this radiation escapes black holes. Over time, the black hole will shrink because energy is coming out. And eventually, one assumes it will evaporate completely. So the question is, well, then what happened to the information that went in? Is it really gone? Hawking's calculation strongly suggests that the radiation that comes out is just totally random. It's thermal radiation. But that means that the information that went in really is gone. It's not somehow subtly encoded in this radiation. Whereas if you take a book and you burn it, well, in practice, the information is gone. But in principle, if you collected everything that came out of the fire and traced back its path, you should be able to reconstruct what's originally in that book. Okay? So black hole, it seems like, should be different, according to Hawking's calculation. The information is just totally gone. Okay, so a lot of people find this objectionable. For one thing, I mentioned that quantum mechanics has to be reversible, right? And this would be something that's inherently non-reversible. So it seems like it contradicts what we know about quantum mechanics. Anyway, there's a lot that can be said on both sides of this question, whether the information really is lost or whether it's somehow subtly encoded in this radiation that's coming out. But people have used some quantum information ideas to talk about that. Because really, part of this puzzle of what happens to information going to the black hole is about information. And quantum information is very good about talking about information. I mean, you want to hear more? I mean, it's...
Sure, but I recall that you had done something.
Yes. Right. So there was a proposal that something special happened at the singularity at the center of the black hole, and that information got out through a procedure that was related to quantum teleportation. Have you guys heard about quantum teleportation? Okay. So then I won't reiterate that. But basic idea is the black hole has a singularity at the middle, and these people were proposing that there's some projection that's happening at the singularity, something special, that's like the measurement in quantum teleportation. And that therefore the state that was outside the black hole, the radiation coming out, is somehow duplicating the information that fell in. Normally in teleportation you have to send a message. Okay, that's not possible with a black hole. Right? A classical message, the outcome of the measurement. It's not possible in a black hole, and the idea is that the singularity is doing something special, so the message is not needed. So anyway, so with John Preskill, we pointed out that this solution was very, very sensitive. That is only very special measurements at the middle that would do this. And if there's if anything going on in the black hole that was to kind of disturb the information as it was falling in, that this solution wouldn't work.
So we're out of time. So let's thank Daniel again.